have led to today happening. That's the Open Door Network, and you'll be able to see the information on the stalls outside. The Tralee Refugee Support Service and the Kerry Diocesan Justice, Peace and Creation Committee. But two others have joined us on that working committee. One is Sister Catherine Tierney, a Bonsecours sister, and Reba King, an individual who, like all of us who are here today, are concerned citizens. Last June, a number, at least two carloads from Kerry, travelled down to a seminar on sex trafficking in Cork. And two of the speakers who are here with us this morning were there. And even though some, I unfortunately have not seen that famous prime time programme, I was appalled at what I heard. And I went up to one of the speakers to say, you know, if we organised a seminar in Kerry, would you come? And he said, I would go anywhere to speak about this issue, if we can do anything. I'm quoting Breda as we prepare today, not knowing would one person or 10 or 20 or 3 come. We felt if one person was saved from the situation of trafficking, our seminar would be worthwhile. So it was with that in mind that we came back, and we had such a great response. I'm a member of the Diocesan Justice Committee, that we said, listen, let's go for this. We need to have an awareness-raising seminar, and that's what's happening today. When we approached the Department of Equality and Justice and Law Reform, they had no hesitation in saying, yes, we will support this. So we're delighted that they were able to support this to make sure that it would happen in such a lovely venue as this, and we acknowledge their support. You can see some exit signs we marked out to you now, and there are toilets outside. I'll hand you over to somebody else, so I'd really be able to enjoy, if enjoy is the word this morning. And that's Peter O'Mahony. Peter O'Mahony isn't a stranger to Kerry. I think, as he said earlier, spent the first 17 years here, and he has the odd relation hanging around, even one maybe in the audience. And we're delighted he's here from the Irish Refugee Council. And we're delighted also that other people are here, but I'm going to leave that to him. Peter, we're looking forward to a great morning, and thanks for taking on this role.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. My job is a very simple one, I suppose, really. I have a number of colleagues here who are going to do all the hard work. But my job is to make sure that things move along. We have a fairly tight schedule. We're starting ever so slightly behind schedule, but no more than that. I'm from the Irish Refugee Council, which is a non-governmental organisation, not in any specialist sense involved in trafficking issues, or in issues of sexual exploitation. We work specifically in the area of asylum and refugee issues, have been doing so since the early 1990s, when asylum and refugee issues were very, very low on people's agenda. I suppose what I am somewhat familiar with is what we would know as smuggling. Many people who manage to seek asylum in a country like Ireland are dependent on people to smuggle them through various countries. And I remember getting a phone call a few months ago from a guy I got to know over the years. I call him Ahmed. It was the 10th anniversary of his arrival in the country, and he mentioned that it was the 10th anniversary of his first contact with the Irish Refugee Council. And I was surprised that anybody would have arrived into our offices on the same day as he arrived in the country, and he acknowledged that, of course, he was dependent on a smuggler who had paved the way for him. He's now an Irish citizen, so things have worked out well for him, and things work out well for some people who are lucky enough to find a benevolent smuggler. The issue of trafficking is clearly a very different issue indeed, where the person is not voluntarily moved from country to country, where the person is coerced, duped, defrauded, and that's what we hope to find out a lot more about today. So we have a number of speakers. We have John O'Reilly, Miriam McGillicuddy, Sister Noreen O'Shea, and Mary Quilley, and I'll introduce them in a little more detail in time. We'll start off with Garda Inspector John O'Reilly. He's Limerick based, has been for many years, but he's talking today primarily, speaking in a private capacity, giving us the benefit primarily of his experience with the UN anti-trafficking team in Bosnia. So, Garda Inspector John O'Reilly. And if anybody has any difficulty hearing or seeing the presentation, you might give us a signal and we'll adjust that.
Good morning. My name is John O'Reilly. I served with the United Nations in Bosnia from February 2002 to May 2003, a total of 15 months. And 11 of those months I spent on a pilot project that was set up to deal with trafficking of human beings. My talk is based on the experiences that I had there, where our unit, our pilot scheme, rescued 265 girls from sexual slavery. These are real people and their stories are based on real life events. I hope my talk will give you an insight into the bravery that will be required before any victim of human trafficking will ask for help, can ask for help. You'll see what they go through and where they have been stripped of all dignity. By asking for help, the victim, male or female, will put their lives in danger. They will also put their lives of their loved ones in danger. Some of the danger may be a perception, some of it is real. It all depends where they come from. How are people trafficked? Our experience were some of them were kidnapped. They were walking down the street, a van was put up, the door opened to be grabbed, pulled in. Not seen again by their family, no sight, no light of them. Others were offered jobs. In their, where they come from, their earnings would be so low, they would be offered a job with income maybe two or three times their annual wages. Could be as a nanny, could be as a waitress, could be as a dancer. They, of course, would love to increase their standard of living, and they check it out. Some of them would go and have coffee with different people, these people they may know, and eventually take the offer of the job and try it. Others we've come across were sold by their family members. One girl in particular was sold by her mother. Others befriended boys and became boyfriends and thought they were in love and everything else, but really the boyfriend was an actual trafficker, and they eventually sold them on, sent them on to different locations, and I'll be on after you, but they were just sold into sexual slavery. Victims. I'll be giving examples of their experiences, basically, but girls, from in order to comply with being a trafficked victim, the trafficker wanted to have sex with different customers and everything else, so you had to break them down. Some of them were raped. There was one girl, she was very headstrong, wouldn't give in to be brought into a club. She wouldn't wear the scanty clothes that they wear in the clubs, and she insisted that she wore her own clothes. She kept insisting, and she was there a couple of nights, went on, and eventually, on one particular night, she saw a room, and they were all paying money to go in. Then she was brought into that room, and they had to pay to watch her being raped, and she was raped. Torture, basements. Another girl, she again wouldn't give in. She was stripped of all her clothes, brought down to a basement. I'm talking a cold basement. Nothing but rubbish and dirt and everything down there. She was starved, left there, and eventually when she decided to comply with the request, she was let out. Threats to loved ones. The traffickers and even bar owners used to pride themselves in knowing where the girls came from. Sometimes they'd even get their addresses, photographs, whatever else. They would portray this to the police and to ourselves as we're interested in these girls and we know where they come from. But what it was a warning to the girls, we know where you come from, we know your family, we know your loved ones. If you run away from here, or if you make a complaint, your loved ones will be killed. And they'd figure out which one would be closest to them, whether it be their sister, their mother, their brother, and they would be the target. Where they come from, the different countries, you would have mafia connections, they'd be very real, families may be in danger of being killed. Others are the perception of it, but the girls, our victims, don't know. Beatings. Numerous beatings. Beatings with screwdrivers, beatings, kicking, beatings, punching, firing knives at them against walls, anything, just basically to break them down. All of these result in the victims losing all faith and trust in mankind. in particular, the one particular club where I just want to give an example of. It summarizes.
Sorry, I'm falling behind with my slides.
Summarizes a club up in the mountainside, six girls in it. They have to have sex with between 13 and 17 men every day. They refuse to do so. The one particular girl who refused to do so again wasn't going to have any of this. As I say, they're being brought here as a job. They end up in a bar, and next thing they realize, they come in, either they'll be told by the trafficker, or they'll be told by the other girls, listen, this is what you have to do here. You have to have sex with the clients, and you have to drink with them. And if you don't comply here, you're going to be sold onto a place that's far worse than here, and you're going to be treated a lot worse. So they're faced with this dilemma. Some of them will submit and go with it, because they're told that they owe them maybe 2,000 km, or which would be equivalent of four or five times their annual salary. They have no way of paying it back. There's no hope of paying it back, so they have to submit, you owe me so much money, and I paid it for you, so you have to pay it back. So they have to go along and earn the money by having sex with customers. One girl, as I said, she refused to do so. She was beaten with a screwdriver so badly that she was bedridden for nearly 10 days across the head. When they recovered and she was brought back out, these are all locked away in rooms now, they have no access to get away. When she came back out, she agreed to submit because she was going to be subjected to the same beating again. And the first client she had to have sex with was a 70-year-old man in the corner. And she consented and she did. Basically, another girl was beaten so badly for not being able to find a television channel. The owner lost it, he jumped on her, he jumped by the radiator, the heat was on top of her. He bet her, again she was bedridden, her friends had to, her other girls had to look after her, she couldn't even eat a medical to the toilet. There was a girl there also in the same club, and she was made pregnant by a judge. She was a couple of months pregnant, she wanted to go home and have the baby. The owner knocked her to the ground and kept kicking her until she aborted on the premises. The owner also decided to have his own private girl, which he kept in his own house. His wife was locked in a room. The wife used to supply food and care for her. He used to go in and use her as a punch bag. He used to rape her, but basically he kept her there so he could beat her. They had a farm, and during the day when the club would be in the morning and then when the club would be open, they were forced to work as slaves on the farm and do the labour. The family would ring fence them and they wouldn't be able to get them. Information was, in this particular case, was obtained by the local police officers, and they were, you know, to remove the girls, and they asked us to help them. We were there monitoring the police and to work with them. But when we got to the girls didn't want to leave. No, we're fine here. Which we wouldn't expect to find. This is the reply. The premier, we found firearms in the premises and that, so we used the laws over there and we closed the premises, so the girls had no place to stay. So we took them away to a shelter, which we had set up with the IPT, that was our handle of the International Police Task Force. Basically, the questions I wish I posed here, we have to ask ourselves some questions to try and understand their situation and position. You know, why did they not ask for help when we were there? You imagine that they jumped at it. Why did they not ask the local police officers for help? Why did they not want to be taken away from the prison? Why did they say everything was okay? They're in a trance-like state. It's a survival technique. Why did they not want to stay in the shelter? When we brought them to the shelter, they didn't want to stay there. They wanted to go back to the bar. It took us 2 to 3 days talking and persuading, cajoling them to stay there. We had no power to keep them there. And again, it took them. They're in a trance-like state. It's a method of survival. They're being stripped of all their dignity. They don't matter. This is a way of life. And as far as they're concerned, we are no better than the traffickers. We would probably rape them and sell them. They want to go back to the place they know. We have to build up trust of them. And it takes a couple of days to come down, you know, as I'll explain later on more about it. But you have to ask what kept them under control. The girls wanted to go back. A lot of communication required to get them to stay. And as I say, if they wanted to go back, we would have to bring them back, even though we knew what they were going back to. There was a sense of security that had to be established with the girls, and this is the most important thing. And then we had interviews that took place, and we started talking to them. They informed us of their stories. Now, the reasons for those silence. The traffickers, they've been deceived by traffickers, both male and female. Some of the girls were shy, one of the girls, you know, who suffered bad previous experiences in life that were bad. They came from poor backgrounds, little hope in life. Some of them were starving. some of them would have fish for their home, and you're looking at a house that's surrounded by mud. Sold, they were sold and resold to brothels, had to pay their own. Some girls would calculate, I owe 2,000 km, so they'd work it off with customers. And they'd calculate, when they're coming up, I'm at my debt nearly paid, now I can go home. They were, if they consisted, if they continued to persist in their yeah, they said that they paid off, they would be sold onto another club where the whole cycle would start again. You know, only 1,500 km after the payment you would pay back. And this goes on, it's a cycle. They had to sleep with customers. They were deceived by clients. Again, when you're breaking in a girl, first of all, she'll be there. The first number of clients will be part of the bar staff, bar owners, friends, whatever else. And of course, the girl would look for help and she'd cry and whatever else. But she would be raped and abused and used. Eventually, the person to be with her would walk and tell the owner if she looked for help, and she would receive more beatings and everything else. So, in the end, you wouldn't ask for help. As I said, deceived by clients and their associates or friends of the owner. The police, we found some of the police officers were involved in it. They got free services with the girls. So, I mean, if they passed on information, they could sleep with the girls. So, again, the police were coming there, they were drinking on the premises, and again, depending where the girls came from, there are different problems with corruption of police in their countries, and the police would be the last one to turn to. But again, police officers were even involved in smuggling them on some occasions too. So again, who do you trust? Survival techniques. As I said, the translite state, one girl, I remember saying, they got my body, but they never got my mind. She used to go away in her head and then when the abuse would happen. I've lost my tracks or anything. The threats to family and loved ones, as I said, the photographs addressed the local mafia. These girls were kept captive 24/7. If you were looking at the man club and the Farrell club in Sarajevo, they had the bar downstairs, the strip joint, the pole, and off the bar you went upstairs into a loft and upstairs to the bedrooms. The girls were kept there, there'd be bar managers, doors were locked, they were locked up 24/7. There was a man on the premises all the time. The girls shared the rooms, two room. That's where they ate, that's where they slept, and that's where they provided the sexual services. They'd come down, when the club were open, they'd be brought down out of the loft. They did their dances, they'd go drinking with clients, and the customers, if you didn't drink and make money, get the clients a drink, you were punished, you were fined, you were beaten. And then you had to go and have sex in upstairs, then in your room, you just take them back down. It was a vicious circle, 24/7. The effects on the girls, as I said, other girls, they became their families. The abuse became the norm. The survivor was the most important thing. Yet their own self-image and self-respect was completely taken away. As I said, they were stripped totally. And one girl that taught me, listen, there, she was asked, why did he keep going back? And I said, we come back for you, coffee. But she said, we don't matter. And it clicked. She really, really believed it. That's when I realized it. They didn't matter. Their loved ones at home, keep the family safe, keep themselves alive wasn't that important, but their loved ones, we don't matter. After some time, someone was then, what will happen is, you're in that state, you really don't matter. So you have to go and have sex with 13, 14 men a night. Eventually, when you're broken, and you really are broken, and stripped away your dignity, the owner will turn around and say, okay, well, I'll give you 20 km or 20 euros for every client. So you're going to have to have sex with many of us, so you take the money. So you take the money. Okay? Now you're taking the money, so be it, they're going to have to do it. Then they start sending the money home, because it's going to be robbed out of them, they don't want to keep it there, they don't trust the people there, so they're allowed to send the money home. And then the likes of myself and other people come in to investigate it, and you look, this isn't trafficking, this is prostitution. They're being paid, they're here willingly, and they send the money home. Look at all the receipts from the money that they sent home. So it's not a trafficking issue, it's prostitution. It's another way of conning the public and the public opinion. The ownership, owners, friendship with officials and police. When we came there first to the bars, the owner come up talking to us, and he helped be polite when we talk away. We do our job. But what the owner was doing actually was using that against us. Because once we were gone away, he said, no, you see, he's my friend. We talking, he was smiling and joking. So the perception is, this is only a show. And as I said, the girls were saying, no, we're happy here, everything is fine. And this is what they've been subjected to. Again, it was another silencing technique. What state of mind is the girl then left him after all this? It's no wonder, she says, she no longer matters. One small comment, and I have to admit it was by chance I said it, and it had a major impact. when I was talking to this girl, she said that she doesn't matter, and she had to go back to the club, and she couldn't take her help. And, you know, I became friends with her because we had met her a number of times. The same girl had six different languages. She's a beautiful looking girl. So I asked her to make me a promise that in the morning thing, when she looked in the mirror and she was washing her face, that she just said, you know, that I do matter. And she did. And it was, she eventually went home, but it was later on, I was reading the same club another night, and I was talking to another girl there, and I missed this particular girl, and we tried to figure out whether they were gone, whether they were sent down to other clubs, whether they were killed or what happened to them, and sometimes you wouldn't know. But this other girl, I said the same thing to her, you know, I asked her, so again, me washing her face, you know, just promising one thing, you know, saying I didn't matter. And she said, I'm not the first one you said that. And so then I knew what she was talking about, and we started talking about the girl. And the other girl did go home. And that second girl, before I left Bosnia, I was in the airport, I was sending some of my colleagues home, and she, I got a tip on the shoulder, and she said, here, buy my ticket. So, a small little thing, I do matter, made a difference in their lives. Our success in Bosnia, I put it down to the regular meetings with the girls and the built-up trust. We had an opportunity to remove them to a secure environment. As I say, it took 2-3 days for them to come down. There was a lovely lady there, she was the owner of a house where we had one of the shelters, Jenna. And when bringing girls at night, and they'd be hyper, they'd be abusive towards me and towards everybody else. And Jenna used to say, you know, they have a long way to come down. And that's exactly what happened. You know, it's a trance-like state, they come back down to reality. It may took 2-3 days, depending on how the girls were abused. But when they realized that you're not going to rape them, you're not going to sell them, and they couldn't pay off the air, I mean, they're there for their interest, then you see the human person coming out, and then the stories come out. As I said, we weren't the police in Bosnia, we were looking after the girls, and we had no interest in any legal or immigration issues, whether it was criminal or immigration, at least to that. I believe a two-tier approach of assisting the girls, like together with an investigative background, and the experience of dealing with victims of abuse worked well for us. The drawbacks in our experience was we had a lack of counselling. We didn't have counselling facilities. You need them there to talk to the girls and to bring them down, to help bring them down. But again, you need something like crisis counselling, is the term I've given it, whereby you have to hit home, hit hard, and get in there to the girls, because you have a very small window to get there, to let them know that you're really out there to help them. Other factors. Threats locate to themselves and to the loved ones at home, the local mafia, they're really perceived. They are factors of silence in the girls. They have no sense of worthiness themselves. They're no longer a matter of their dignity have been taken away. They really have been stripped naked of every shred of dignity. Their present families are the girls who suffer similar abuse, and they're all there. And in the girls as well, you would have a house mother, as we term them. A girl there who would be heading on them. If somebody was cracking or likely to ask for help, they would support it onto them. And again, you're looking at beat and punishment, etc. So you have to watch that. Even when you were talking to girls, you didn't know if any particular girl was a house mother. And the house mother eventually even came and asked us for help before they left Bosnia. So, I mean, you can get through them. Other girls then would have been trafficked. And in order to get out of the traffic, they became traffickers themselves. They would have come back home to their home villages or home squares, met other girls, and said, oh yeah, I was over there in Italy or in Bosnia or whatever it is, we can get you a job. And they actually became traffickers themselves. Size of the problem, I'll just finish after it. Basically, the problem of trafficking women and young girls is not confined to Bosnia, it's just my experience in Bosnia. Bosnia was the gateway to human trafficking to Western Europe. Women and children transported to the cities of Paris, London, Berlin, Rome, and other cities. One of our seeds that never end was a woman that started off the project in Bosnia, and she gave a talk in Brussels one day. She was talking about STOP, as we were known at that time. And two women from France came up, they used to walk with girls in the street, and we'd been trying to figure out what STOP was. There was girls in the street that they were helping in Paris, and they were talking about stop this and stop, stop, stop. Which means that the girls in the street in Paris had to have been trafficked through Bosnia in order to know what stop. So that just shows you the network. In Ireland, some questions you have to ponder about in relation to Ireland. At this point in time, victims will come to this country, I maintain that they have been totally stripped of their dignity. They will accept money, you know. But it's not like they're going to be locked up, as in Bosnia, locked up 24/7. And kept prisoners. Some of them will be, but they're at a different stage. So we're going to have to ask ourselves, how do we identify a victim in Ireland? How should we approach the victim in Ireland? How do we recruit them? How do we expect girls to respond to offers of assistance? Or what other efforts or actions are necessary? And what do we do? And what do you do when you're told, everything is okay, I'm happy here? Well, that was all many times. Thank you.
thank you, John. That was excellent. And that gave us a very shocking, very disturbing introduction using just one example, the example of the Bosnian experience of how people are used and abused, stripped of all their dignity. We're going to move on, and now if you look at the Irish situation and the legal situation, our next speaker is Mary McGillicuddy, who's a solicitor, a law lecturer, and a Tralee Town Councillor. She's going to talk to us about the current legal situation in Ireland as it applies now, what is needed to make things safe, and how all this can affect the status of individuals. So, Miriam McGillicuddy.
Good morning, everyone. You're great to come around here this morning. Very dedicated to hearing an effort coming on this difficult topic. And I suppose I'll be following on a more legalistic note after the tragic stories that John told us there. And it only highlights, I'll be outlining the law here. The problem is when people don't make complaints, the law can't be enforced. And that is part of the problem as well. So now, this presentation is incredibly long, but what I've done is I've tried to encapsulate a lot of the law in relation to immigration generally in Ireland and its effect on adults and minors in this handout. We won't be able to get through it all, but we'll get through as much as we can of it, and hopefully you'll find it of some help to you as background in the topic. I suppose human trafficking is defined as the commerce of people, men, women and minors. And there is a definition there. Trafficking across frontiers really is what we're looking at. So it's in the immigration area that we particularly have to look out for the vulnerable person who might be coming in our borders and might be affected by it. I'm working on the assumption that vulnerability and the ruthlessness of immigrants when they move to a new country, language barriers, and not having the support network they have at home and all that leaves them vulnerable, especially in the case of unaccompanied minors, and I'll be looking in particular at the minor situation. The US State Department report on trafficking in people there refers to the various types of showing clear link between migration and voluntary servitude or trafficking. It's the vulnerability that leaves these people open to a situation where they can be open to trafficking. It's not only sexual trafficking we'll be talking about, but trafficking in relation to labour, sexual exploitation, and horrifyingly enough, organs as well. The other thing is when people are coming into a country illegally, they may be preyed upon by people who hang on to their papers and keep them in that vulnerable situation. That's a definition of trafficking there from the UN protocol there. And as you can see, there's points there relating to deception, coercion, abuse of vulnerable people, using a powerful higher position to keep them in a servitude and exploitative situation, either sexual labour or, as I said, horrifyingly enough, the removal of organ situation, that people could actually be sold or killed for their organs. The State Department UN report, having said all that, our picture in Ireland is actually optimistic enough. We come up in the UN State Department report on trafficking persons 2006. What they say about us is that we're tier one. In other words, we comply with certain minimum standards in dealing with trafficking in our legislation. And we'll be passing a new Criminal Justice Trafficking Act, hopefully later this year. If not next year, hopefully this year, if we all keep pushing after it. And basically, we have, as has been highlighted already, smuggling legislation which would stop smuggling, but not legislation that would stop trafficking, particularly in sexual exploitation, labour, and organs area. So we all have to push for that coming in. They also said about the importance of resourcing the NGOs like the Irish Refugee Council and other bodies who would be highlighting this and other issues of vulnerability in relation to immigration. They felt that Ireland was on the right track and that our government were showing leadership in the situation. Just on immigrants generally, just a few little points.
I just wanted to highlight some of the words that you've used. Aliens is no longer a word that you've used. Sigourney Weaver ruined it in the Aliens, the movie, so we don't use that anymore. And when we're looking at people coming into this country, it should be asylum seekers who are people seeking refugee status, refugees who actually have the status, and in this program, refugees who are invited in. There's about 200 per annum at the moment coming in there. Other types of applications would be humanitarian leave to remain, where people have been refused refugee status and they can apply for humanitarian leave to remain. And then we look at people coming into the country illegally. They're obviously very vulnerable. And there will be a new subsidiary protection coming in. It's just come in end of 2006, where there was a risk of serious harm, and this could help people in a trafficking situation. If they found they were trafficked, they could apply for subsidiary protection. There would be an avenue there for them to apply for legal status. As I say, the legal status in relation to, we won't be able to go through all the slides in this, but people applying for refugee status in this country, they come in as asylum seekers, go into the asylum process, and hopefully either in first instance or on appeal, they get their refugee status. If that fails, then their only option is judicial review through the High Court or humanitarian leave to remain. The Refugee Legal Service helps people when they're applying for their refugee status in this country originally, and also with the humanitarian leave to remain application. One of the worries I would have about vulnerable people, in particular unaccompanied minors, is that they've no help in the process. They've no advocate, they mightn't have a guardian ad litem, and they're very vulnerable in that particular situation. People who are out working in the community, maybe self-employed people, maybe people kind of working for themselves to some extent who come in, maybe married to an Irish citizen or an applying for humanitarian leave to remain, are in a very strong position. They've built up social links, they're adults, they can put together a very good application to remain. The unaccompanied minor can't. And that's one big worry I would have in the situation. Likewise, with people who maybe come in here illegally, trafficked in, they wouldn't be in a position to make a strong application either. With children, if an unaccompanied child comes into this country, into the court, it seems that a large proportion of them slip through the net and they're unreported, undocumented. The problem then is that if they're found as a child, maybe wandering around or whatever, they go into the care of the health board, but they don't always go into the refugee or asylum seeker process. There might be no application made on their behalf, and that's another worry. So there's a few different ways of kind of dealing with that, and I look at them further down the line. Just before we move on, citizenship. Every refugee that I would be aware of, and I do a good bit of immigration law, mainly in the humanitarian leave to remain applications and in family reunification applications, but most refugees would want, if they want to settle in this country, want citizenship status. That's the kind of be all and end all. And as I say, once people are in the country 5 out of 9 years, they can apply for their foreign citizenship status. The problem is then, though, once they apply and get citizenship, they lose their right to bring the family over. That could be a problem if they have siblings, nephews, nieces, young children that should be with them, that they're in local parentage to. So what would be particularly, if people want to apply for family reunification, maybe for unaccompanied minors, their spouses, their partners, they need to stay a refugee and not become a citizen until that's done. That's a hiatus actually in our system, in our whole immigration law at the moment, that once a person becomes an Irish citizen, they lose the right to have an avenue to reunite with their family, which is against European conventions, and we do need some kind of an avenue to allow this to happen. I've gone, the ways of applying for citizenship are all documented in your notes. They would be, how do you apply for citizenship in Ireland? Anyone tell me? How long do you have to be here again?
5 years.
Out of?
9
years, great. post-nuptial, if you get married to an Irish citizen, how long do you have to be here? How long do you have to be married to them, first of all, before you can apply for citizenship?
Three.
Brilliant. And you have to be in the country then, does anyone know? Two out of 4 years. That just came in last year. That's all that mentioned in the notes there. Now, qualification for citizenship, there's one other thing I just wanted to mention there. Post-nuptial is all there. The descent scenario, we all know that, father, mother, grandparents and that. If you're legally resident of the country here 10 years and don't want to become an Irish citizen because you're proud of, person is proud of their own citizenship, they can get unlimited permission to remain. There's one other thing there. Children born in Ireland where their parents were here 3 years will get citizenship at the discretion of the minister. An interesting one there, deserted infant children may be conferred on the basis that they were presumed to be born in the state. So that would be conferred with our citizenship, and obviously presidential honour will give citizenship as well. Now, legislation, I've set it out there in your notes. That's all the legislation really in relation to immigration for adults and children. There's a ton of it, isn't there? So we're hardly going to get through it all today, but we make an old stab at it. The one we're most concerned about is the one at the bottom, obviously, the new proposed criminal law on trafficking in persons and sexual offences bill 2006 there. If you have a quick look at your next section, then there, that's the legislation protecting children in relation to if Child Care Act protects children throughout the country if they're in need of being abused, neglected. Child abduction protects children in relation to being abducted across borders. So if you just have a little look at your notes there, and hopefully we have PowerPoint notes up later on. If you look at page 6 there, and you'll see there's a European dimension as well, which we'll mention next. But moving on to page 7 there, the most important act we look at there is the Refugee Act. Well, a person can only become a refugee in Ireland at the moment where they're well-founded fear of being persecuted. And it's a very high standard, and only about 1 in 7 people actually get through that process to become a refugee. Large amounts of people are obviously deported or have to apply for humanitarian aid for me. Immigration Acts then deal with deportation. The illegal immigrants, that's a European directive. We need to worry about that one. It's a document. If you have a refugee status or this subsidiary protection. But the reason everybody wants to become an Irish citizen is it's much easier to get in and out of the country with an Irish passport than a travel document. So that's one of the reasons people are kind of rushing into citizenship as well. Now, criminal law trafficking in persons and sexual offences. This is the new bill I mentioned to you, and it's worth having a look at it because it's specifically on the topic here. It includes labour, sexual and organ exploitation. Sexual exploitation is a very wide definition, child pornography, prostitution and sexual activity. And offences there to traffic for exploitation and all that, where it's coercion, force, threats, abduction, deception or fraud. And you see the huge penalties, fine or imprisonment for life with a child, and a fine imprisonment for 14 years with an adult. So this act will deal, hopefully, when it comes in, effectively with child and female and male trafficking, the commodity that we were talking about earlier on, that would stop anything of that nature. Again, though, as John said, there has to be a two-pronged approach. One of the worries, I suppose, as well, in this legislation, there is the defence of honest mistake, like there was in our criminal sexual offences legislation, and that may cause a little bit of a problem down the line. Again, they're talking about changing the law of allowing the defence of honest mistake in relation to the age of a child, so we have to see, watch that space, as it were, in relation to that. Now, it's an offence under the Act to sell children for sexual exploitation, soliciting or paying for purpose of sexually exploiting a child, and there's different offences depending on the age group, different penalties depending on the age group. There is a defence of reasonable belief that the child is aged 18, and that's in our other sexual offences legislation, as we'll see later on as well. Now, I just want to touch briefly, so when that comes in, that Act, And it's out for general circulation at the moment, and all the NGOs, organisations are putting in their speed in relation to it, and I think some of the other speakers will be mentioning it, that hopefully that will go some way towards fulfilling our international obligations and also ensuring that child and people trafficking in Ireland can be attacked and dealt with. The next list of laws I'm going into there are laws relating to protection for the child. So we just have a quick little look at them. Now, if you just have a little look at your handouts there, I've gone through all the protections there in relation to minors, the various acts that cover them. The main ones we want to look at are the Child Care Act. If a child is unaccompanied, he can be handed over to the Health Board, he or she can be handed over to the Health Board and protected. Ideally, they should go for refugee status. I just want to finish up at the end with my suggestions. I've set out all the laws and just a few little suggestions for reform. Oh yeah, just one last point on that last slide there, sorry. One of the problems we hear, there's no regulation of au pairs throughout the EU, and that's something that really needs to be strongly addressed. They fall between labour and educational law, so they fall between two stools. There's no regulation in the area, and there needs to be. So, trafficking in unaccompanied minors, there's various recommendations that have come down over the years. But the main thing, I suppose, is for unaccompanied minors and separated children, that there's no one to advocate for them. They would need family advocacy or some mentor to mind them in the situation. Loads of minors have gone missing because there's improper documentation of unaccompanied minors, and that's something that needs to be addressed down the line. I think in the area of minors and minor asylum seekers, the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child and the suggestions that have come out from a committee recently about how we can improve our child law in Ireland will lift all boats. It lifts both our Irish children and asylum seeking and trafficked children. If the new amendment comes into the Constitution protecting children's rights, that will help the unaccompanied trafficked child even more. Just the last point, just one few little other points. Just my personal recommendations there. Irish citizens should have a right to family reunification, advocacy, mentoring, guardian and heating for the separated child, different criteria for unaccompanied child applications other than the normal adult applier in applying for humanitarian leave to remain and for family reunification. They need to be put in a special category. And just to note that the stats for unaccompanied minors, only one in five of them actually get status. And they wouldn't be pushing the right buttons really. There wouldn't be much of a hope of pushing the right buttons to get in, and yet they're totally vulnerable people in our society trying to get some kind of regularity to their situation and protection. And then I've just given you a load of resources. I'm sorry about the rush, but you can see it's a kind of a huge area, and you have all the material there to look up whenever you need it. And if you have any questions, we can take them at the end. Okay.
And I thank Miriam for what was a very extensive call to the frameworks that exist, the legislation that we have, and that legislation that is being planned. We have a quick couple of minutes before we go for a coffee break, so John and Mary might be available to take a quick question if anybody would like to throw us a question or two before we break. Yeah, and if you'd like to identify yourself, if that helps.
My name is Jacob Kelly. I would like to ask John what legislation there is regarding men caught frequenting his
presence. In case the question hasn't been heard at the back, the question is to Father John, what legislation exists to tackle men who use the services of trafficked women?
The offences here in Ireland refer to people who provide the brothels or offer the services. The offences refer to being on the street rather than in private premises. That's a difficulty. The men themselves frequenting the services is not an issue. You know, they're not, the offence will be committed by people that offer the services or provide a premises for a product.
So, in this country under the law, a prostitute is breaking the law.
You should offer the services.
The person who buys the service is not breaking any law. Is that not an anomaly?
So I think that's pointing out the anomaly that is there, that on the one hand, the person providing the service is guilty of an offence, somebody using the service and abusing the service is not.
Depending on the agency, you know, there's different legislation that comes in at the state, and basically the offence is seriously just the main approach.
One further question? Yeah. And again, if you're at the front, just be conscious that people at the back may not necessarily hear you, so I may repeat the question.
Okay, I'd like to ask the second speaker. There's something in international law about the trafficking. As the first speaker spoke about, there are people who stop, they call stoppers. Okay, for example, like it happened that they traced the person who has been trafficked from one jurisdiction to the other jurisdiction, and they have identified the person. So what happened between the, because they're from different countries and they're brought into a different country. So what happened between the international law that comes between this? Because the person may want to go back to the country. So what is the procedure between the two countries?
So a question to Miriam about the procedure where somebody has been trafficked from one country to another and where the person has ultimately been identified, how does it work in terms of more than one country?
It depends on whether it's an EU country or not, but there is provision for international cooperation and extradition within the EU in relation to somebody who's from guilty or who would be liable for an offence of trafficking.
Okay,
there's police cooperation, in other words, between European countries particularly,
okay,
and international cooperation in this area.
Let's take hypothetical, the person, the country that comes for, not in the Geneva Convention, or maybe it's not assigned to any particular convention. And you have traced that the person, let's say, is from South America or Cuba, and the person wants to go back to the family. There's a total conflict between the international law of these two countries. The country of origin has not assigned to the United Nations Convention, any of that. So what happened to the person being extradited back to their country? Because there's no binding to the country that he has resided.
Are you talking about the victim? Or
the victim, yeah.
Oh, the victim. The victim, it's a matter for himself or herself, whether they want to go back or not. There's a provision for, you know, like the immigration organisation, I think, arrange for people to get home if they want to go home.
The IOM, the International Organisation for Migration. Mm-hmm. But I think your question points out that inevitably there are difficulties and complexities even in one country, but certainly where more than one country is involved. Any last question before we... Yeah.
Can I ask Mary Dodd this morning, just ask what countries the girls came from?
The girls we dealt with came from Moldova, Ukraine, Romania, mainly. But trafficking is all over. You know, the news this morning, on the radio, this is the World Report, they were talking about 3,000 children in America disappear every year. It's a worldwide problem. You know, it's just not any place. If you have movement in the different economies, you will have human trafficking, and you have it globally.
And is it within Bosnia itself as well?
No, you see, psychologists will tell you more about this than I can, but if you're using somebody from a different location, you can disassociate with them. And so it's not the same. We did come across a few local girls, should we say, from Bosnia. But they were mainly people that kind of wandered into it or just taken in, but the majority were basically from different countries, which you could easily, you know, disassociate. And that seemed to me, from a psychologist's point of view, it was an important aspect.
Of course, relating that to the Irish context, while we can't link it directly to trafficking in any or all cases, at least some hundreds of children have gone missing in Ireland, having come into Ireland as migrants, having typically been unaccompanied minors or separated children, have vanished from the face of the earth effectively. Some may well have voluntarily left and wanted to go back to another country, to their home country, but very clearly many of them are unaccounted for and most likely unsafe. I think, unless there is a further... Yeah, the one last question, let me go for...
Good morning, Fiona Mullins is my name. I'm just wondering, have any of those children ever been identified or found by the Gardaí? I know that there was a headline in the Irish Times last year, 250 children have gone missing. Have they ever come to any attention, your authority's attention?
I haven't got the answer to the question.
I can say that some have, yes, some have. Some children do turn up in Ireland or elsewhere, but sadly the vast majority, no. Okay, we'll break for that. We're running just a slight bit behind schedule. I think it's a very worthwhile first session, and we are hoping to be back after coffee at near to midday if we possibly can. Maybe just after midday, we start. Thank you. I hope everybody got their coffee. We're going to restart. We have two further speakers and then a session of discussion, next steps, and then a further meeting. So next on our agenda today is Sister Noreen O'Shea. Sister Noreen is a Good Shepherd sister, and she's going to speak about the topic from a faith perspective and outline some of the responses from faith-based organizations. Sister Noreen.
Thank you for coming back from your coffee break, and I want to thank in a particular way the organising committee for asking me to be part of today's awareness raising. I'm very pleased that Kerry is going to start its own awareness raising campaign on trafficking, and I'm sure you were very impressed with previous speakers, John and Miriam, and I am very going to follow on their footsteps, but on a different vein, because I'm talking about human trafficking from faith-based involvement. So I'm very happy to be here on three scores. One is that I'm a Good Shepherd sister, and Good Shepherd sisters around the world are very involved in helping women out of prostitution and also in helping women who have been trafficked. As a member and a founding member and a board member of RUHAMA. I'm sure many of you have heard of RUHAMA. It's an organisation in Dublin, a faith-based organisation that reaches out to women in prostitution. And thirdly, I'm here because since November 2005, a group of members of different congregations in Ireland, about 12 congregations in all, we have been meeting to raise awareness about the issue of trafficking here in Ireland. So, the first thing I want to say about this topic, which I think has dawned on you at this stage, is that it is a very difficult topic. And what happens is that we refuse to acknowledge that it's happening here in Ireland. But I can tell you here, from my experience in RUHAMA, that over the past few years, 200 trafficked women in Ireland have been identified. Contact has been made with 101 of those, and RUHAMA has been able to help 48 women. And RUHAMA is just a small organisation in Dublin, and if that number of people were met by that small organisation, then I'm sure we're only really touching the tip of the iceberg. And it reminds me a lot of the 70s, some of you here might remember the 70s, when people started talking about domestic violence. You might remember that Aaron Prizzi over in England was writing about this reality. And she wrote a book called Scream Softly or the Neighbours Might Hear. And I remember being in Cork at the time, I was working with homeless women, and people were saying, well, you know, maybe it's happening in London, and it could be happening in Dublin, Not in Cork. And I don't know if any of you remember Mrs. Keane, she was a doula in Oliver Plunkett Street, and she knew that it was happening in Cork. And she used to drag me around with her to meetings, and she used to say, you tell them that it's happening here. So it is a little bit like what John was talking about, that there is the distancing. And why the problem is at a distance, it's, well, it's terrible, but thank God it's not here. I think as regards the issue of trafficking, we find that it goes through the same kind of process, that you say, oh, maybe it's happened someplace else, maybe then a little place closer, and then finally that you say, well, if it can be happening in Port Arlington, as was obvious from the primetime programme, why couldn't it be happening in Tralee? So I think that's part of the hurdle we have to get over. John's stories this morning were really gruesome. And I think today that one of the things that we might do as a faith community is to give a voice to the people who have been trafficked. And I was very privileged to be part of research that Good Shepherd Sister from New York, Dr. Elaine Hayes, did. She did it in France, in Italy, in Belgium, in Sicily, in Sri Lanka, Korea, Thailand, and the Philippines. And her object was to meet women who had been trafficked. And most of them she met in centres where they were being cared for by Good Shepherd Sisters or other congregations. And in talking to the trafficked women, she asked them different questions. But one of them was, what was the hardest part about being trafficked? And in doing this, we're giving a voice in here in this room this morning to women who out there at this time are trapped and exploited and deceived into trafficking. And this is part of the role of a faith community, to be a voice for those who have no voice, while at the same time helping them to find their own voice. So I want you to listen with reverence as these voices are being spoken by members of yourselves this morning. And as you're listening to the voice, remember, this could be the voice of your own daughter, your sister, your niece, your aunt, or your mother, if circumstances were different. So we have the first voices, what was hardest in being trafficked, and then the second one is, what was your greatest fear being trafficked?
I was 11 years old when they took me.
This was my life, what right did they have to take it?
It's impossible to forget what I've been through.
I complied because I did not want to die.
The bottom of the customers.
I am very bitter. No girl goes into this on her own. A hatred grew within me.
And then the responses to the question, what was your greatest fear during the time you were trafficked?
That I would lose my mind.
That all my dreams would vanish.
That I would be killed by a customer.
Getting AIDS and STD.
One of the girls jumped from a building and died, and I envied her.
That what they did to others, they would do to me.
That they would kill me, or tell my parents what I was doing.
So in honouring the voices of women who have been trafficked, I want to let you know that Sister Elaine is trying to put the results of all her research together, and hopefully before the end of the year she will have published her book, which she will call The Voice of Trafficked Women. And she sees herself giving a voice to what she calls the most silent, dispossessed, and nameless of women at this present time. And just to say that as I was doing some of the research with her, I just did it in Paris and in Italy, what really shocked me altogether was to discover that some traffickers were women up to then that I had stupidly thought that it was only men who were doing the trafficking. And I think, John, you have a part to that as well. So that's Dr. Elaine Hayes, if you ever see a book coming up in my life. So our topic is about human trafficking, and maybe if we remember for a moment what it means to be human, and to know that the people we are talking about are not another species from another planet. They are human beings, and we are human beings. And all of us as human beings want to feel that we are loved, want to be able to love, want to be able to communicate with other people, want to feel that we are worthwhile. You matter, as John said in his presentation, and that we are doing something worthwhile, and we all want to improve ourselves, and we all want some adventure in life. Now, anybody who doesn't subscribe to that, we let you go, because then you've got you. And I suppose if we go back to Maslow, he would be talking about all of us having basic needs, like physiological needs for food and shelter, safety needs, belongingness needs, esteem needs. We need to feel that we matter. And then self-actualization needs, and to develop the creative potential of each. And you will remember from the stories how every one of those basic human needs is attacked in some way in the process of trafficking. And then as human beings, we notice that in the past 20 years or so, our possibility for relating and expressing ourselves has been greatly increased by the mobile phones. I've heard people say, what did we do before when we were without mobile phones? And that is a great creativity in technology. Also, the internet has really made a village out of this world, and it is a marvellous asset. And as well as that, low-cost travel has meant that we have been able to travel to places naturally that we wouldn't have dreamt of previously. And we see that all of these wonderful creative developments can be used constructively for communication, for education, for enhancing our humanness. But unfortunately, they are also being used destructively for exploitation. So we also are aware that they are the major tools, mobile phones, internet, and low-cost travel are the major tools in promoting trafficking across the globe. And trafficking in women at this time in our history is the third most lucrative business, criminal business. First being trafficking in illegal arms, the second being trafficking in drugs. But the trafficking in women is less risky because you have less chance of getting caught at borders. And this is terrible to say it this way, but your product is more reusable. So I turn now to the fact that we are talking about the topic of human trafficking in the context of faith communities. And what I mean by faith communities is communities like parish communities, justice and peace groups, religious communities. In short, any group who are gathered around belief in God and a God and in the Christian reality we're talking about, a group who are promoting Christian values, gospel values. And one of the most basic of the Christian values is that of the dignity of the human person. We're also talking about care and compassion, in helping people who are in need. Another value is working for a just society. And then, in our values, we are also talking about not judging people. We judge and we condemn exploitation and behavior that is not promoting a human being's life, but we don't judge a person. We always keep the door open to the humanity of the perpetrator, that humanity is warped at the moment, but we do not judge, and we do not give up on the possibility of transformation for anyone. I have sat around a table with a group where one of the people who are now helping to try and alleviate the situation was a former king. So we don't close the door to the possible transformation of anybody. Now, one of the advantages that we have as faith communities is that we have a worldwide network. As you know, from a parish here to a parish in Nigeria, there is a way of linking. The link is already there. So our networks are worldwide, and our expertise in terms of noticing those who are in need of care is well established and over generations. And one of the most important things that we have to remember now is that we are confronting a terrible indignity to the human person. And that indignity is that it's using a human being as a commodity and depriving the person of her freedom. As citizens, as Sylvia said at the beginning, and as faith communities, there is an onus on us to unmask this scandal of our times and work towards changing the way of human interaction that keeps it in place. Our wide geography and our expertise in caring stands to us. Now, at a conference on trafficking in Rome in 2002, at which I represented Ruhana, there was a wonderful speaker there called Lisa Thompson. I don't know if she's any relation, but Lisa Thompson from the Salvation Army. And she suggested that there are four common threads that unite us in the 21st century in the fight against trafficking today, which is referred to as 21st century slavery. And these unite us with the key to the success of the abolition of 18th and 19th century trafficking. And these four threads she identified as, first of all, a transformation of Christian faith. Now, she sees this as a faith that touches our hearts. We never do anything about this problem unless our hearts are touched. And so the first thing is that our hearts need to be touched. And after that, we have to experience a righteous indignation around the systemic injustice that, as she said, condemns human life in our so-called civilized societies to this kind of indignity. So really, the heart has to be touched, and then we have to fire up our passion against the atrocities that are happening. The third point you talked about is the possession of a prophetic voice. We must be the prophetic voice speaking the truth to the heads of state, the rich and the powerful, the penniless and the powerless alike, leading people to a recognition and outrage about trafficking. And then the fourth thread is compulsion to action. Now, I think each of us can know that, you know, we have to feel it in our hearts, we have to feel the passion inside, we have to try and voice our indignation, and then together, out of that righteous indignation, be galvanized into some kind of meaningful action. I would say myself, in terms of that journey, that at that conference, one of the questions that was posed by John Allen, an American reporter, he looked around at us and he said, how many of you here in this room are part of an international network? And loads of people, including myself, put up our hands. And he said, what I would appeal to you, he said, is to use those international networks of care and compassion constructively to counteract the destructive criminal networks that are keeping trafficking in place. So that was the key question that sort of fired my passion and galvanized me into some sort of action against this. and that we will do something about facing this horrific crime. Now I'm watching the time and I realise that I've got way over. So maybe what I'll do is talk about the fact that there are some responses being made by faith communities in this time. I talked about Rouhana in Dublin, and I have a handout that will be passed around, Inca's story, which you can take away with you. It's the story of a woman from Bolivia who thought she was coming to Ireland. She was a hairdresser, she had two children back home. She thought she was coming here for a better job and better wages. She was told to buy a mobile phone when she got to the airport, and the trafficker at the airport had a picture of her on his mobile phone, and then she was taken to an apartment where there were three other women from Bolivia, and then it dawned on her that what she was coming for was something very different altogether. She was given orders through text messages on her mobile as to where she was to be and what clients she was to see. She was given a bank account number into which she was to lodge all the earnings, and she was threatened that her children back home would be killed if she didn't obey. Now the other feature of it was that every week she was in a different place, and this is one of the ploys because they don't want the women to develop relationships or to be seen regularly in any one place that they might be befriended by anybody. So it wasn't until she went into a bank and was lodging money, and the money was laundered, that a bank official pulled her aside, and then the police were brought in, and then she ended up in Mountjoy prison. And Rouhana has a very good link with Mountjoy, and from the story they figured that she was trafficked and with the help of the International Organization of Migration and the Gardaí, which the link between Rouhana and the Gardaí is very strong. Her choice was to return home, and she was allowed. She was helped to get back because some people knew a congregation of sisters out in Bolivia that were able to make sure that her going back was a safe going back, that it wasn't going back into the hands of the traffickers again. As I said, since November 2005, after Dr. Elaine Hayes spoke to a group in Dublin, we have groups of it's mostly sisters. Now, I'd have to say that it's great to see men at this morning's gathering, and it's, I think, more and more we need to see more men present. But it's mostly sisters who are meeting in Dublin to try and raise awareness about this issue within our own groups, and shortly we will have a leaflet for parishes. We're preparing it at the moment, and this leaflet will be sent around so that all parishes can get some information that they can manage and that will galvanise them into action. One of the things that we did was we wanted to make contact with TDs and senators, and through the good offices of Simon Coveney, who tutored us, we actually got into the Dáil Theatre on the 22nd of November, and we gave four workshops back to back, a half an hour each, raising the awareness of Dáil deputies and senators about the inadequacies in the new bill that's been brought in that Miriam talked about. And they were very receptive, and they certainly gave us a very good hearing. We also helped to send some points to the Conference of Bishops in Maynooth, and Bishop Bill and myself have been talking about that, and we're very grateful that you took it up. There's also a group in Galway that meets. I know the groups in Cork meet, which have its sisters and Franciscan International and Dominicans for Justice and Peace and Caritas have all made representations to the United Nations in an attempt to convey the pain and tragedy of trafficking victims to the international decision makers. And in Rome, a group have got together and they have come up with a very good information kit. It's a resource kit, really, and it focuses on prevention, rehabilitation, and political action. And it has been translated into several languages. And I give you the email there if you wanted to get a copy for yourself. because it is very well drawn out, it's a very good resource. But of course, with Miriam's notes from this morning, it will be more enhanced because you have the Irish situation done so clearly. And then in the Netherlands, they have done out this video, which is fairly gruesome, called Anna. And then there's this other video called Exit, which can be useful if you were trying to raise awareness in groups. So that's just talking about Ireland and Rome. Also, there are faith communities in Italy, Nigeria, England, Australia, Canada, South Africa, the Netherlands, Germany, Thailand, and the Philippines, all trying to raise awareness, all trying to provide safe housing for trafficked people, and all doing their bit to change the law and to change the situations that keep trafficking in place in the first. Really, no, just beg for a few minutes. I tell you, I want you to go away from here with some challenges ringing in your ear. And just because challenge starts with C, I'm starting all of the challenges with C as well. That'll make it easier, won't it? So the first challenge, I think, in terms of what can you do, you might be saying, the first thing is have a conversation about this. Take your story, the Inca story, leaflet with you, and talk about it. With the people you know, talk about it in the gym, talk about it in the pub, talk about it with your parish priest, with your bishop, with senators, TDs. I think we have to make this an election issue because the voices that we heard here this morning are not going to be heard in the normal circumstances. So it's incumbent on us to be their voice. The second point is collaboration. Nothing can be done in this sphere alone. Every group has to work in with other groups, and you have to build coalitions with others so that something is done around this injustice. What we would say is that the passion of faith communities combined with the power of politics will shift it, but we have to collaborate together around it. And one of the Baptist ministers at the conference in Rome was saying that it's very good to look for somebody in government who might be equally passionate on the situation. And to date, we have found that Simon Copley and Kathleen Lynch are two key people in that area. Now, care and compassion, of course, that is to be alert to the symptoms, the absence of documents or presenting false documents or shoplifting, which is a way of trying to get attention. And also to know that, like, if in time things develop and there's safe housing or some kind of program developed around here, that people with language skills are invaluable. I know in Dublin there's a sister who's a missionary in Romania, and she's marvelous now helping around language with Romanian girls. Computer skills, legal advice, all of that. Development workers from the area who have been out in other third world countries, they're a great resource. Now we have to confront the channels that keep this kind of trafficking in place. And we have to look at things like corporate entertainment or stag parties that see a visit to a brothel or a lap dancing club as normal. That needs to be challenged. And tour operators that organise travel for the purpose of sexually exploiting vulnerable people, they need to be boycotted. And we have to change, now this is the part one, because it is aimed just to change mindset. But we have to change society's mindset that accepts that prostitution is necessary to meet the needs of some males in society. I don't know if you're familiar with an organisation in France called UME. They have been working with victims of prostitution for over 50 years. And they did a huge survey recently of the public in France. They sent out 13,000 questionnaires and got 6,000 back. And in that, they found that though women were more strongly against prostitution and were more insistent that the people who used women for prostitution should be condemned. Still, the shocking piece that came out was that women agreed, just as much as men, that prostitution is a necessity for men. Now, if we did a survey here, what would the answer be? Prostitution is not a necessity for anybody. It is not a necessary evil. It's not the world's oldest profession. It's not fate. It's not a job. It's not a trade, even though people like to use the term sex trade. It is an indignity and an abuse of the dignity of the human being. It reduces her to a commodity. So we have to be very clear about the mindset and the way women even can fall for that belief. Now we need to change the law. The law around adults, the law around children might be coming out a bit better, but we're saying that adults can't be sold either. And we'd be advocating the Swedish system, where in Swedish law it is the person who's looking for the services of prostitution that gets prosecuted. And that has, I'm not sure how long it is in Sweden, but I know that it has made a significant difference. And in changing the law, you know, no TD up there in the law is going to change anything unless there's pressure put on it, or her. And we were very aware of that the day of the workshop in the law. We had one Kerry senator present, Joe Toole. So if you want to link in with him, he know what you're talking about. And of course, Joe Higgins was there, who being a Kerry man but representing Dublin. So if at election time this isn't brought up, the women aren't going to be able to say it. So it's up to ourselves, anyone who knows, to bring it forward. The last is cut out the consumerism of the demand. If there was no demand, there'd be no supply. And the demand is not for the traffickers. It's not the traffickers' demand. It's that the traffickers are the middlemen between men in Ireland who have poor demanding these services. So that's why it's a men's issue as much as a women's issue. I know that when we started in Ruhama first in Dublin, we used to say that for every woman we met in prostitution, there were at least 10 men. Now, for every trafficked woman, we say there are at least 30 men because of the way the trafficked girls are being asked to work. We always think the demand is coming from outsiders. It couldn't be our beloved Irishmen, but that's what we have to track. And finally, as Christian communities, we are communities who are trying to build a society of justice, who are trying to honour and respect the integral value of each individual. We're trying to be caring and compassionate to individuals, but at the same time we have to work at the macro level and try and change the situations that keep this in place. And we, as Christian communities, can always pray. It might be sophisticated to say that, but it is a reality that there's a power there. There's a bigger power behind us than is behind the traffickers, if we only link in. And as communities of faith, we have a staying power. So my final thing to you is to bring the passion of our faith communities to influence the power of government to counter this violation of human rights locally and globally, and to give our voice and our volume to this cry for justice. I have sheets with the list of challenges for you. On the other side of it, I have an updated version of the Good Samaritan parable, which will be read in churches on the 15th of July. My hope would be that by the 15th of July, 6 months from now, that you will have done a lot in your faith communities to raise awareness. Thank you very much.
you very much indeed, Sister Maureen. Now, the last of our presentation and the second last session is with Mary Quilly. We will follow that with a short discussion and next steps session, and I would estimate that we'd be hoping to finish at around 20 past one in total. So we're moving on with Mary Quilly from the Cork Stop Sex Trafficking Campaign, and she's going to outline for us the work of the campaign to date, including work with politicians, the campaign, and the results to date. Thank you.
I won't keep too long. I know, you know, we're on much time, especially after a morning like this where we want things to kind of continue and happen. So thank you for inviting me, and I'm really glad to be here. My background is I've been working for the Sexual Violence Centre, which was a rape crisis centre, since 1982. So I've been kind of fairly active. And one thing I'm very used to, which is coming up in the sex trafficking thing, is how to know, and the whole thing about numbers. And the whole thing, I'd say, when we started the centre in Cork, there was 82 crimes and to do with sexual assaults and child abuse in the whole country reported. You know, so when people kind of ask you about numbers, I think you just kind of pass it off and say, you know, that'll come. So we're just here really to lend our support to the campaign. What happened in Cork in June? There was a meeting in UCC organised by Women's Studies. It was a really hot, warm day. We weren't sure how many would come. John came and he really got people motivated and moving. Over 100 people turned up, which we thought was great. At the end of it, I mean, I have to admit I was pretty clueless as to what the legislation was and as to what the situation in Ireland was, but I really knew at the end of it that if somebody didn't kind of coordinate a campaign, people would be left feeling, that was really good, but why can't we do something? Why are things just kind of left hanging? You know, we want to kind of get involved and do something. That's just from the meeting. So we decided we need to have two aims. You need to keep things simple. I mean, I know the legislation is fairly complex around asylum seekers, around refugees, around the whole lot. So for people, we just kind of decided we have two aims. One would be to raise awareness around the issue, and the second would be change legislation. And the main thing we've been saying to people is that victims of trafficking are not offered protection. There is kind of legislation covered for traffickers and all this kind of stuff, but there's no legislation to protect victims. So what we did, I think, is important. If you are running a campaign like this, we've been meeting every couple of weeks, and at each meeting, we wanted something to come out at the end of it. We wanted to keep informing ourselves. So the meetings would be maybe an hour and a half long, because people don't get tired. You find people who get involved in campaigns like this are also involved in a lot of other things, so they want things to kind of move on. So we just felt it was important for presentations to come, where people say, like Siobhan Mullally, who's a doctor in UCC in law, and Kathleen Lynch, who's been involved a lot. And I suppose the whole thing of the 16 days of action was coming up, which was between 25th November and the 10th of December, which was a really good opportunity to highlight what was happening. So we did a number of things during those 16 days. One was Labour Party were meeting in the Silver Spring, so we took the opportunity to give them a presentation. But I think with any campaign, you have to be visible. I think that's hugely important, to be visible, and to look good, and to look professional, and to kind of mix with as many other organisations and communities as you can. So we did get, even down to letterheads, we didn't have any funding. The centre decided to fund it initially, because I've always believed in working that way. Do something, and then if you want money, go after them, but don't let that kind of hold you back, you'll get nowhere. And I just felt for writing to the politicians, we wrote to every politician in the country, every senator, every TD, every county councillor, every trade union, every hospital, everybody, as far as we could think of. Now, I didn't write them all, because that's the importance of coordinating and being together, like somebody who worked as a midwife did all the medical stuff. Sister Jane, who's here, did all the religious orders. That's how we did it, because I knew if I wrote a letter to a certain organisation, we'd be binned. But we were operating as a really coordinated kind of group, and we wanted to look good, we wanted to look effective, we wanted to look professional, but above all, we wanted to look like we're here to stay, and we're here until things change. One of the big things we did was on the streets. I mean, during 16 days, you can see there's a few conferences on. The thing we did basically was on the streets getting signatures, which was very difficult. We got about 8,000 signatures, so we averaged about 2,000 signatures a day. And that was just doing 2 hours a day, because by that stage, Everybody was frozen, there's petitions outside. You know the ones I want. We didn't have the leaflets at that stage that we have now, but we didn't have handouts of people, just kind of one page kind of saying what we wanted. And it was quite effective just kind of saying, there's no protection, there's no protection, there's no protection. And then if people want more information, they can have it. We did have a meeting in the office in the Sexual Violence Centre and invited all the politicians, and I think, as you see from the photographs, three turned up. But what we did do, there's about 50 people came to the meeting, I think. What I did do was on the wall, I had photographs of every single politician, and I had the letter under it, what they said, or just a blank page, if they hadn't responded at all. But I know what they were saying there that night was, if we make this an election issue, Cathy Lynch was saying that when she goes around the doors, people don't talk about issues. They might mention one or two things, but don't really bring up a particular issue. So 10 people each night said to a politician, what about sex trafficking? That's an issue. And that's what we need to keep doing, just keep highlighting it and keep talking about it, and that's kind of how things will change. That was us in the street. We didn't get good media coverage, I think, because of it. And it is about catching attention, because if you catch attention, then people will listen and kind of see what you want and see what you're about. We've got a small bit of funding. We've got 5,000 to cover kind of what we're doing. Again, to keep the group itself motivated and interested, we've been having meetings with various people, and that was John Driscoll, who's a guard in Dublin, who works in the area, who said he's involved in a lot of organisations looking at trafficking. I know John will probably know his title and exactly where he works, but I think it's important to keep everybody moving and find out what other authorities are doing and what they feel about stuff and where they're at. And, you know, basically what I found at that meeting, though, was quite good. I really get the impression that if the guards thought they had a chance for conviction, they'd do something, they'd help. But it was really interesting now what you heard this morning about, you know, a lot of time women pay for their own tickets or are told to put money in different banks, you know, the money laundering stuff there. One of the points he made was that he felt a lot of women were very trafficked because they'd actually paid for their own ticket and were putting money in bank accounts, so therefore they took from that, well then they weren't trafficked. So it seems that we need to keep talking about and keep raising awareness about. Have your argument ready, I think you just go for it. And my attitude to legalising prostitution is doing nothing for women. It's just taking respectable businessmen into the pimps or the women who are pimping. That's really all it's doing. And the whole stuff in Amsterdam about the women's health being better, that's been shown not to be true. Because if you look at it, the women are being tested, but the men coming into the market. So the men can put any kind of infection into them or onto them as they want. It's really to protect the men. That's what this is about. So as long as you're ready to take that on, and argue the case about, you know, prostitution isn't here to stay. I'm sick and tired of it, of hearing that phrase. And the Swedish way is the way to go, so we all have a certain information about that. So, where do we go from here? I think we're going to continue raising awareness. We'll probably use Valentine's Day and days like that to really be up the streets again. I know the National Forum on Europe are talking about organising a conference in the South sometime at the end of March, and the degree of sex trafficking is going to be a major topic on that. We'll keep lobbying TDs. I mean, I think if TDs get 100 letters, it would be brilliant rather than just one. Keep lobbying trade unions, keep lobbying other organisations, see what their attitude is, what their policies is, because, you know, just keep in your head. I'll just keep in my head a film we had on during the CIT week, and that we had on the Driscoll, Sex Slaves, which is quite effective. It's about a man whose wife was sold by his friend, and he's trying to trace her around the world, around Europe, and trying to get her back. And just talking to four or five women on that video and about their experience, like, it's just terrific. So I think anytime I feel like a bit, you know, I've so much to do with the centre and so much other things, I just think about some of those women and I think, I have nothing to do. Or if I, coming down this morning, feel I'm tired, I feel this has nothing to do with what they're going through. And I mean, we have the opportunity. Time is on our side. Legislation needs to be changed. It won't be changed this year because of no votes in it, but by God, it has to be changed in the next 12 months. So if we can really rally around and keep talking about it, well then, we can make a difference. So thank you. We have a website, and it'd be great. We're trying to continue the petition on the website, so it's sexualviolence.ie. So we're trying to get as many people as possible to, you know, sign up to that. And we have submissions that we've sent around, everything is on the website, www.sexualviolence.ie.
Many thanks, Mary. We're going to move to wrapping up fairly shortly, but we have a couple of minutes for some questions. So if anybody has a question, we'd be very happy to take them. We won't delay you. We're conscious that people may have other plans, so we'll be finishing in a few minutes. Yeah?
I've got a question for Rory. Is there any knowledge at all about whether young men are also being trafficked for the purpose of prostitution?
Not sure if that was heard at the back. The question is whether young men might also be trafficked.
The answer to that is yes, that is a part of this phenomenon as well. But I'm speaking from the experience we have in connection with women. Yeah, but it is. Perfect.
Okay, any other? Yeah?
In order to try and raise awareness on all of this, which you've been trying to promote, and all the people who've been speaking have been trying to promote it, I get a lot of jokes by email every day, and they go around the world in about a day, you know, as soon as something happens. And if everybody in this room was prepared to give you or somebody their email address and was going to forward it to 10 people and ask them to forward it to 10 people with the appropriate instructions and requests, I think that a lot of this could be could go around the world very fast, especially around the country anyway.
Okay, thank you for that. And I think you were asked on your way in to leave your email address, so if you didn't have that chance already, you might kindly do that at the registration desk. I think the forms may still be available as you're leaving.
And if Mary gave us an email and said, send this on, you know, it would have the right wording. And
petitions,
a petition. I mean, it would go very fast. And as an election issue, everybody in Dublin would have it by Monday, you know.
Okay. Any other question or suggestion? Sylvia?
Both Noreen and Mary have really said it in a way. Mary said it at the conference in Cork, that like she was getting ready to go to their own seminar, and then people were kind of saying, that house over there, that's where that happens. That you have to be prepared to take on that challenge. And when that's talked about in an organisation that you know, whether going to the laptop dance, getting my words right here. Anyway, if that's a night, it's entertainment, and you're in company, and it's quite acceptable in the company you're in, it really does take quite a lot of courage to go out and speak and say that out. So, you know, sometimes it's easier to send something by email, and I wouldn't knock that either. But actually, just to raise that and have the courage of your convictions in your small, ordinary little places where you're discussing things, to raise it, because it's interesting, the people who didn't come, I think, today, as the organisers, we contacted all sorts of people. But I think even the title put people off.
Yeah.
And I think that's scary in itself. They almost thought the title was sordid, I think. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting. But what we're trying to say, yes, it is sordid. That's why we're trying to stop it.
But I think you can turn that around. You've had a very substantial attendance here today, and I think a very substantial volume of information that will assist in moving things forward. So I'm going to ask Gráinne to give us an idea of what next steps are in terms of perhaps a further meeting or expanding a campaign here. And can I, on my own behalf, thank you all for the very substantial contributions this morning. I might take one if I see one question coming before I do that. I'm happy to do that.
Sorry, just one quick suggestion. Alison Borden from the Voice, we had a couple of interpreters here this morning. It's an awful pity that they weren't needed, Polish, Czech, Russian interpreters. I just wanted to say that some of you know already that we have a particular community rate for translation and interpreting service. But on any issues like this, we really have rock bottom rates for if you want to get any flyers translated into all languages, or you need an interpreter to interview somebody, please contact us. We're just here for you.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much for that. Any last ones? Yes, Doreen.
I just want to thank the people who were the voice for the traffic tour. Thanks,
the volunteers.
Amen.
In terms of numbers, I think for Doreen, in terms of you mentioned was it 200 during the number of Antonella. What is there a figure for the exchange of trafficking?
That was the first question that was asked by the senators and TDs in the Dáil, too, how many? And that question was put by Joe Higgins. And even as he put the question, he kind of took it back and said, well, look, one is too many. So it is impossible to know how many because of the invisibility and because of the lack of adequate research at the moment. And that's the way it will be because that's the nature of that topic.
And of those nationalities you are coming across, are there particular groups of nationalities?
They're Eastern Europe, Africa, especially Nigerian, and Latin America, Bolivian, and Ecuador.
And any evidence of Irish people being trafficked?
No. You see, what I do say is that in John Hopkins University in the States, it has now been identified that the trafficking mafia have identified Ireland as an easy port of entry and as an affluent country. So the trafficking is generally from a poor country to an affluent country. Now, when we were at the Mission Alive exhibition in Cork, I know somebody was asking groups of secondary school children as they were coming around, trafficking, do you think it happens? Oh, yes, it happens. Where does it happen? Into the States. And then when somebody said, actually, somebody being brought in through Prime 4 and being used by Kerry men, they're not so good. But that is the reality. If we have no adequate research that shows it.
Could I address a question to John and ask about how the guard that were involved in Boston, how did that happen? How did they get involved?
The question there is in relation to how the guard that were involved in the first instance in this operation in Bosnia.
With the United Nations, it's now changed to the European Union Police Mission. With the United Nations, there was 35 Gardaí annually went to Bosnia, serving with the United Nations. When I arrived there, there was a process of an induction course whereby you just introduced to what's the scene in Bosnia. You'd have done one before you left here as well. The political scene, the history, and how the UN works out there. But during this induction course, we came across, we were informed of a new pilot scheme that was being launched out there, and that was on the human trafficking, the stop. It was set up because there was, if you go back in the papers, there was a lot of articles about allegations that UN personnel were involved in human trafficking. And in response to that, they decided to set up this project. This pilot scheme. It was from that I was sitting down, I saw this thing, and I had experience in investigation of sexual abuse and serious crime, so it caught my attention, and that's where I went. There was in total, there was 11 Gardaí involved in the program, which are very highly recommended. So they're all back in Ireland.
Okay, I think I'll leave it
and
at that, and the last round, yeah. Take this on to the next steps.
Okay, I won't take up too much time, but firstly I suppose I'd just like to thank our panel of speakers that came today. I think it was a very illuminating discussion from everybody. Just a few points that kind of stuck out in my head about the speakers, which was John. You said 265 victims were saved. It's fantastic. The key words that kind of rang in my head since have been torture, threat, blackmail, deception, which leads to the vulnerability of all these victims. And I suppose another thing, not to forget the compassionate faces of the Gardaí. I mean, John, you spoke about the friendships you developed with these women, so you made it personal. You made them feel that they did matter. And I suppose we have representation here as well from the Gardaí immigration officers in Tralee and Killarney, Frank and John, Jim and Liz, and you know, it's good to see them here, and thank you. Miriam, I suppose the extensive presentation that you gave on the immigration system and laws and what's wrong and what needs to be done and what's right about it, it's going to be good reading for people. Also, I suppose one thing that Miriam said, if people don't make complaints, you know, the law cannot be enforced. that's something that should be looked into. Sister Noreen, you spoke about just the 200 women that have been identified by yourselves over the last number of years, and I suppose, as she said, it can be happening in any locality, it's just that it isn't identified and awareness hasn't been created. And it's the dignity of the human person. And I think hats off to the people running the safe houses for the women that are helping them rebuild their lives and help them into the future. Mary, what can I say? We look up to you, you know, and thank you for giving us permission to use your sign today for all our posters and everything. We really, I suppose, on behalf of the committee, we'd like to say whatever we can do. This is just our first step here today in raising awareness in the Kerry area, and we do want to continue this and expand on it. So we'll probably have you tormented over the next couple of months. And then finally, Peter O'Mahony. I mean, I've worked with Peter through my work over the last 5 years. It's always a pleasure dealing with him, and I have to say thank you very, very much for coming down today. So hula boss to all of you. I want to go on to thank the committee members, a fantastic group of people, very motivated and really, really worked hard to get today off. Kerry Justice and Peace representing them, Anne McKenzie, she's up there somewhere, over there, Rita Kelly, Sylvia Thompson, the Open Door Network, Sinead Kavanagh, Kerry Rape Crisis Centre, Alice Kavanagh. Independence then, Frida King, and also Sister Catherine Tierney, and Sister Finian, and ourselves through the Refugee Support Services. And just in mind, you're asking about follow-ups. We will be having a follow-up meeting on the 20th of February in St. John's Pastoral Centre at 7:30. Everybody's welcome. If people have suggestions, ideas, how we can, you know, carry this on, and the more the support, the better. Alison said about the translations, it was a pity that we didn't have people from other communities here today, but all the posters were translated into Russian, Czech, and